Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. When we think of apes, we tend to think of gorillas and chimpanzees. But whether you like it or not, biologically, we humans are in the same family of great apes called hominids, as they are. There are more similarities than differences among the members of that family tree, and in fact, we share a very high percentage of our DNA with chimps. But there's a species of hominid called bonobos, who live in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa, which is little known and fairly rare, and with which we share 98.7% of our DNA. My gosh, you'd think they look like people you know. But actually, they look like smaller chimps and are in fact very much like humans socially, except for one important trait. They rarely fight. My guest today is a research scientist at Duke University named Vanessa Woods, who studies these animals and is dedicated to understanding them and also to protecting them from extinction, because living where they live, they are very endangered. Welcome, Vanessa.
Hi, Court. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks so much for being on. I think probably a lot of people have never heard of bonobos. Why don't you just start by telling us more about bonobos?
Well, bonobos are really incredible, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you say they're the only great apes that don't kill each other. So we are most closely related to chimpanzees and bonobos, but while humans and chimpanzees they have war, they have murder, their females are beaten, and their infants are occasionally killed. Bonobos don't do any of that. And so, you know, scientifically, that's just really interesting, because how is it that we share 98.7% of our DNA, and yet this kind of darker side seems to be completely missing in bonobos?
So what are some other characteristics of bonobo behavior in society? I mean, do males...
Okay, well, let's just get this out of the way. They have a lot of sex.
All right.
I wrote a book called Bonobo Handshake, because basically in bonobos, sex is like a handshake. And they do it across genders. They do it across age. I mean, anything, any way you can think of, bonobos have already done it. But I guess scientifically why this is interesting is because the way in which sex is used. So it is really a conflict resolution, and it seems to be the mechanism by which bonobos can sort of switch off any escalating violence.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to lead you directly into the sex thing, although we were going to get there, but no way around it, right? The bonobo elephant in the room.
We might as well just go. The only way through it is
through it. Yeah, right. But I mean, I think, from what I've read, they're matriarchal societies, and I'm wondering if that has something to do with their nonviolence, generally speaking. I mean, let's be blunt, right?
Well, you know, it's always better when females are in charge, and bonobos, the females are definitely in charge. The highest ranking bonobo is always a female, and, they just keep things nicely under control. Like, if a male sort of starts to get all puffed up and acting like a chimpanzee, the females will do something called, they call it in Congo, they call correcting the male. So, for instance, there's this bonobo called Mimi at Lolea Bonobo, and I once saw Tatanga, who was an up-and-coming male, just walk up to her and just backhand her across the face, like hard. I mean, it was so hard, she almost got whiplash. Mm. And, this is something that we see in chimpanzees all the time. I mean, the first thing a male does when they hit adolescence is they start beating up all the females in the group, starting with their mothers. So Mimi, when this happened, just sort of like turned and looked at him, and she just had this killer cold stare. And within 5 seconds, five of her best female girlfriends had come, and they had beaten up Tatanga and were chasing him around the forest. So it is not that bonobos don't have any violence. They do. But the violence is used to keep the peace, whereas chimpanzees and humans, it seems to be to dominate and control.
So the violence is used to suppress violence or to end it or whatever. But let's talk a little bit more about bonobos in general, because I think, you know, people aren't very familiar with them. What are their current circumstances? I said where they live, but, you know, how many of them are there, and how are they endangered and threatened where they live?
Right. Well, I mean, what you said is about where they live. That's really crucial to everything. They only live in one country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has seen the most brutal and bloody war of any of the wars since World War II. I mean, you know, I think the death toll is 5.2 million in counting. But, you know, the instability is also an asset because the Democratic Republic of Congo has been so difficult. Actually, a large part of their forest is intact. So the Congo Basin is the second largest forest in the world after the Amazon, and it is incredible when you fly over it. It's it's hard to imagine, you know, because all we see and hear about is wilderness being destructed. This vast, untouched forest, and this is where bonobos live. It is very difficult to penetrate. And so, I mean, the short answer is we don't know how many bonobos there are. You know, it's definitely, you couldn't fill a football stadium with the amount of bonobos that are left, but it's difficult to pin down an accurate number.
So even though that area that they inhabit is very large and the war kind of activity doesn't intrude much into it, there still must be lots of villagers here and there throughout that whole area. And do they catch them and eat them? And do they keep them, you know, catch
there
them
is,
to sell them for pets?
And, so hunting bonobos is illegal. You know, they still do hunt them because obviously the standard of living of these people is very low. The Congo Basin is like three times the size of France. So the population density is quite low. So, I mean, bonobos would have a good shot, except for what the rest of the world is creating, which is a thriving international market in live apes. And the UN released a report on this, I think it was in 2013, about how what used to happen with great apes was that, you know, the hunters, you know, these sort of poor villagers were going in and hunting the apes for meat, and then incidentally there'd be this sort of small orphan bonobo attached to their dead mother, and then they try and sell that bonobo. But what's happening now, driven by markets in the Middle East and China and even parts of Europe, are that these infant apes, like gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, orangutans, they are going for vast sums of money. So what used to be an opportunistic trade is now this kind of centralized crime ring, if you will, you know, and that's seeing to like a rapid decline of all the great apes.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Vanessa Woods, a research scientist at Duke University, who studies a kind of a little-known great ape, a close relative of ours, called the bonobo. And it lives in the Democratic Republic of Congo in Africa. As she mentioned earlier in the show, she wrote a book called Bonobo Handshake, and the subtitle is A Memoir of Love and Adventure in the Congo, published in 2010, and you said that the handshake is kind of a euphemism for the fact that instead of shaking hands when they meet, they basically have sex a lot. And I'd say monkeys in general are known for being pretty highly sexed, but are bonobos really noticeably different from other monkeys in that regard? I mean, is it, you know, how often
yes.
this is a constant
yes, they
thing?
They are definitely one of the most promiscuous species. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why they're so little known, in America anyway, in France, everybody knows what a bonobo is and nobody knows what a chimpanzee is. So it's the opposite. But I guess they look so human. So when two females are GG rubbering, that's when they, you know, rub their clitorises together until, you know, they look like they're orgasming to me. It looks so human. They have sex in the missionary position. They have a whole suite of Kama Sutra positions. And it's definitely different to monkeys. I mean, I've watched capuchin monkeys in the Costa Rican wilderness. And they also have a lot of sex, but they just don't have the same amount of sex as bonobos. Bonobos are in a class of their own.
So you really, it's pretty clear to you, it sounds like that their nonviolence is directly tied to the huge amount of sex they have, that it basically gets rid of their aggressions and they've structured their society around having fun together rather than fighting together.
It definitely seems to be a mechanism to de-escalate the conflict. And, you know, that's what me and a lot of other researchers have seen. And so we work mainly in the sanctuary, Lolea, Bonobo, and Congo. And there, it's the sexual behavior is even augmented even more because whenever bonobos in the wild, they usually have sex around food. And in the sanctuary, you know, they're fed like three times a day. So this is three regular times a day that you can see all sorts of amazing behaviors happen. So, yes, it's extremely interesting in that this is the mechanism. And, you know, for all our technology and all our, you know, so-called intelligence, we haven't found a way to not kill each other. So, you know, this is why bonobos are interesting and important.
Yeah, so it's always party time in bonobo land. It must be interesting when you take young grad students there to have them the first day or two to get used to that, to the scene.
it, yeah, I mean, I have picked my jaw off the floor a number of times. And, you know, I think there was a movie called Bonobos that just got released that was, you know, based on a human society that had modeled themselves on bonobos.
Oh, my gosh.
Quite funny.
Planet of the Bonobos. So what's the focus of your bonobo-related research at Duke? I mean, you mentioned chimpanzees and so on. I mean, what do you really, scientifically, what do you focus on?
All sorts of things. I mean, bonobos are just so interesting in so many ways. So, you know, our research group has looked at the way they make economic decisions, the way they relate to strangers, the way they help each other. And the graduate students from our research group, Yingzi Tan, has done an incredible project on the fact that bonobos actually prefer to help strangers than they do their group mates. So, I mean, we usually think of altruism as something that's unique to humans, you know, doing something for someone else at a cost to yourself. And Tan actually found that, you know, bonobos are the perfect Good Samaritan. They will, you know, help someone they don't know over someone they do know. So this is also really interesting. Bonobos are just fascinating for all sorts of reasons.
Do they seem to you to have a sense of group community where they are not just interested in their own pursuits and their own pleasure and their own interests, but that they want to protect the group as a whole in an active and obvious way?
You know, all great apes are incredibly social. So if there's ever an outside threat, they definitely band together. I don't think this is something that's unique to bonobos, though.
Apart from the violence thing that we discussed earlier, how different are they from chimpanzees? And I guess the two of them are our closest great ape relatives, right? So what are the obvious differences apart from that one thing between those
two?
Well,
I mean, so that is the thing. In a lot of ways, they are extremely similar. You know, they look really similar. It's difficult to tell a chimpanzee from a bonobo unless you know what you're looking for. But it really is the psychology. And I guess, you know, some of the physiological differences as well. So our research group has found different ways that their hormones react to stressful situations. So if two males are feeding together in chimpanzees, their testosterone goes up, which is, you know, their readiness to compete. But in bonobos, their cortisol goes up. So, you know, and this is sort of like a related to stress. So, you know, if chimpanzees enter a potentially, you know, competitive situation, they get all reared up and ready to go. Whereas bonobos, you know, they start to get really anxious. So there's so many differences between them. And it just really only starting to get an idea of how, what it is inside bonobos that, you know, accounts for this extraordinary behavior that we see.
Well, I'm wondering if their nonviolent tendency is kind of counterproductive to them. I mean, how do they deal with more aggressive animals like chimpanzees when they run into them? Do they run from them? Do they fight them? And are they capable of defending themselves?
Well, that's the convenient thing about the Congo River. Bonobos and chimpanzees do not share the same habitat, and they don't share their habitat with anyone that they would have to compete with, including gorillas. And so, you know, Richard Wrangham at Harvard, this is one of his theories, is that because chimpanzees share their habitat with gorillas, there's a lot more competition, and chimpanzees, you know, go for the high-reaching fruits, and, you know, sometimes they hunt for meat, and there's just more of a chance of food deprivation, which has led to the sort of, you know, more competitive lifestyle. Whereas bonobos, who live north of the Congo River, they are not competing for this kind of, it's just called THV. It's salad. Bonobos can live on salad if they need to. You know, they'll also eat fruit and, you know, opportunistically hunt, although this is, you know, seen very rarely. But, you know, if they get hungry, they can have a salad. Chimpanzees, if they get hungry, they're in trouble. So, you know, this might account for some of the differences we see between them.
So, Vanessa, throughout this whole discussion, I'm really kind of thinking, and maybe a lot of our listeners are too, of the parallels with human society and what you're just describing about their isolation and how it protects their ability to be passive in a way. I wonder whether it means or kind of implies that a utopian, peaceful society can only really be sustainable when it's not under threat by more aggressive groups.
Humans are so interesting because we're so two-faced. you know, in some ways, we're more peaceful than bonobos. I mean, look at the things we do for each other,
sure.
The incredible societies we construct, you know, the law enforcement, the justice system. I mean, we can be so, so altruistic. But then, you know, on the about face, we can just, you know, we're capable of war and genocide and doing horrible things to each other. And, you know, I think that this has something to do with people that we see as being like us. So it's, you know, if we see someone as being like us in terms of being an in-group, we can be incredibly kind and compassionate towards them. But if we see someone as being different, and, you know, this can be across a range of categories, like, you know, race, religion, you know, skin color, a sports team. If we see someone as being not like us, then that's when, you know, we're capable of incredible cruelty. So I'm not really sure whether it's to do with geographic isolation, but more about how we identify with each other.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, yeah, we're kind of bimodal in that way, and you never know what can cause the coin to flip, huh?
Right, and that's why bonobos are important, because they may provide the answer. You know, if we can look at the mechanisms and the way in which they avoid conflict and, you know, peacefully coexist, then that may help us.
So you talked about the female dominance in the matriarchal society and how that's kind of maintained, but there must be within that, there must be dominant female individuals, right? There must be some queen. And so how do such people establish, or such monkeys establish and maintain their dominance, if not through some kind of intimidation? How do they do that?
Well, like I said, there is violence in bonobo society. And so it's just, I think some of it's matrilineal, but then bonobo adolescents leave. So I think, you know, females get to the top the same way that other, you know, great apes get to the top, but it's just not the severe violence. And also what's really important to bonobo females is that they have coalitions. You know, the alpha female bonobo has, you know, a cohort of girlfriends, basically, that she depends on. And I think this is what allows bonobos to kind of reverse that order of male dominance, is because in the few female-dominated species that there are, the females are bigger than the male, like black widow spiders, where the female occasionally eats her mate, or hyenas, where the females are just as big as the males, and by the way, they have penises. So, you know, in bonobos, like, the females can be 60% of the size of the males, but they're still dominant. And so, you know, this is a lot to do with female alliances and sort of the cohort of friends that the alpha female has.
So in your research, do you also explicitly make comparisons with human behavior? I mean, do you kind of compare this to the way humans interact, and do you try to draw parallels at all, or is
it
strictly?
Well, sure. I mean, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand human behavior by looking at human behavior and what makes us unique by looking at our closest living relatives, which are chimpanzees and bonobos.
I know you're a mother of two young children, and I'm sure your research gives you insights into parenting those little monkeys and vice versa. The parenting maybe gives you insight into your research sometimes. Can you give me a few examples of that?
Well, it was really funny, you know, because when we were going to our GP was very, you know, about the schedules and, you know, where they're sleeping. And, you know, in Australia, co-sleeping isn't even recommended officially anymore. And I hadn't been around people who had young children before, and so we just basically brought up the kids like baby bonobos. Like, you know, we slept with them, they did what they wanted when they wanted. And I don't know if it's the best example, because bonobo societies are very baby dominated. Like, if there is like a date, like within 100 meters of a bonobo, like if anybody else thinks about getting it, like woe betide them. But you know, yeah, we were pretty baby dominated. You know, we carried them everywhere, they slept with us, we fed them whenever they wanted. So I guess that was informed the parenting. As to how having kids has informed, you know, how we see bonobos, it just really enforced how human they are and how slim the boundary is between us. And, you know, we've been trying for years, I mean, for decades, to find what is this line that divides us from the great apes. And it just, it becomes so hard, really, to pin it down.
I mentioned at the beginning that you're heavily involved in efforts to protect bonobos from predation, mainly by humans. And then you mentioned a sanctuary. Why don't you tell us about that?
So Lolea Bonobo was started by this incredible woman called Claudine Andre. And she started with a bonobo who kind of almost fell into her lap over 15 years ago. And since then, she has built this wonderful sanctuary. It's a paradise, and that's what it's named after. Lolea Bonobo means the paradise of the bonobos, and it is the only bonobo sanctuary. It's the largest population of bonobos in the world, and it's a beautiful story because, you know, she educates so many people, and most of them are Congolese. The sanctuary receives something like 30,000 visitors, and you know, most of them are from Congo. And not only that, she's managed to release the bonobos back into the wild in their natural habitat. So Lolea Bonobo is just, it's an amazing place if you're a researcher or a bonobo. And the bonobos that end up there are very lucky because all of them are orphans from the bushmeat and illegal trafficking trade in live apes.
Wow. How big is the sanctuary?
It's about 100 hectares, so it's really large. I mean, they're living in a large natural space, which is wonderful for us because, you know, they're more, you know, they're not animals sitting in a cage. They have all the habitat and natural environment that they would if they were, you know, and they're developing all the same skills that they would if they had stayed in the wild.
So a hectare is about 2.5 acres. I think that's about 250 acres then.
I think so. It's large. It used to be the last dictator of Congo, Mobutu Sese Seko. He used to use the sanctuary as his weekend retreat.
Yes, so I was going to ask you, with the Congo being as unstable a place as it is really and has been for a long, long time, does Claudine have pull with politicians like, you know, the prime minister or whatever, and with the military and the people who she needs basically to protect her?
She knows everybody. Yeah. And a lot of the officials in the government called her Soso Pembe, which means the white chicken. Mm. And apparently every village has got a white chicken, which, you know, you have to respect and also be a little wary of. But she's an incredible diplomat, so she has basically done more for bonobo conservation than anyone else I know.
So they've got the white chicken devoting her life to them, and she seems to be a pretty competent person. So does she raise funds, too? You mentioned the visitors. I guess they pay a small fee to get in, but
most of the money comes from donations and grants. So anyone can sponsor a bonobo through the website Lolea Bonobo, and, you know, these funds are really important because they're non-earmarked. So they go to whatever needs to be done, and through the U.S., organization, 1% goes to overhead. So all the money that gets donated basically goes straight to Congo to help the bonobos.
You mentioned a while back in the show a movie called Bonobos, and I'd understood from you earlier when we first touched base that there's a documentary film in the works. Is that the same thing, or are they two different things?
They're two different things. All these movies about bonobos are coming out. So Claudine Andre actually has a movie called Bonobos that is all about her and her work that is coming out, I think, later on this year in the U.S. But the other movie is a crazy English movie about some people living in a house in England. I haven't seen it yet, but hopefully there'll be lots of movies about bonobos coming out. But those are the two I know of right now.
You know, there's something I've really never understood completely, and if you can do this in 30 seconds or so, I don't know if it's possible, but the distinction between primates, monkeys, and apes, and I've used the term monkeys here, and I think that's probably wrong. These are not monkeys, they're great apes, but I know they're related and subsets of each other, but Vanessa, can you quickly break down that distinction for us? Are they all primates to start with?
I can do it in 5 seconds.
Okay.
Monkeys have tails. And then the second thing is that apes eat monkeys. there's about as much similarity between a great ape and a monkey as there is between a cat and a dog. This is, you know, in the great tree of life, you know, there's lots of connections between them, but great apes are very close related to human. We are the fifth great apes, and their monkeys are somewhere, you know, not too distant really related, but a pretty far away.
But monkeys and apes are all primates?
They're all primates, yes.
Okay, and there's some other primates in addition, which are lemurs and different other little odds.
Lemurs, Madagascar, yes.
Okay, so primates are a big group of animals anyway.
Yeah, the primates are the big family, and the great apes are all kind of like cousins, and monkeys are, you know, that fourth removed great aunt that you never see.
Well, I want to say that apart from her book Bonobo Handshake, which we've mentioned a couple times, Vanessa is an accomplished journalist and writer in many science-related fields. And with her husband, Brian Hare, who she mentioned briefly a little while ago, he's an anthropology professor at Duke. The two of them co-authored a book on the genius of dogs. And Vanessa's written a series of award-winning children's books based on different science topics and hundreds of popular science articles for everything from the Wall Street Journal to National Geographic. That's my little plug for you, but you're really an accomplished science writer.
I do. Science communication is important, and it's fun, and, you know, it's something both Brian and I are passionate about.
And that's something we're trying to do right now, right? There are so many endangered species all over the world, including mountain gorillas. So why should we care so much about bonobos?
I think, you know, and I love mountain gorillas. I love polar bears. I love all these endangered species that are kind of slipping from our grasp. But, you know, the real value in bonobos is what they can teach us about ourselves, because, you know, in the past we've always modeled ourselves on chimpanzees, and, you know, chimpanzees are wonderful. They have these amazing social connections, they have empathy, they have love, but, you know, they also have this darker side just like we do. And, you know, bonobos, they are so closely related to us, and yet they don't have this. So, you know, I mean we know that we're not supposed to kill each other. We know that we're supposed to be less violent. And yet, you know, for all this intelligence we have not managed to do what bonobos have done. And so, you know, if we're ever going to have, you know, this one planet, this one ideal where horrible things don't happen to people all the time, then bonobos are going to be really crucial for understanding that. And, you know, if we lose bonobos, then we've really lost the only chance we have of understanding ourselves.
Vanessa, we just have a minute or so left, so one last question for you. Has this research and the exposure to bonobos changed you personally?
Yes, absolutely. I used to be so despondent, I guess, about the fate of the human race. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, so, you know, I grew up with whaling and the hunting and you know, the sort of the way our climate's changing. And so all the time you just hear this hammering on about how everything's a disaster and that the human race is doomed. I mean, you know, in terms of social media and the access we have to information, it is just so easy for us to see the horrible things that are happening, whether it's just outside our front doorstep or whether it's over the other side of the world. And, you know, this can be hard. And what bonobos have done is they've given me hope, because I know that there's a way that we can overcome, you know, this darker side to our nature. There is a way that we can live where we feel that other people are other humans and not objects, or not, you know, and not demonize them or think that, you know, they deserve what it is that's coming to them. So, you know, bonobos have just given me hope that there's a way that we can reach this ideal that I think we're all striving towards. And, you know, and that's a good thing.
Well, that is hopeful and that is positive. We have to leave it there. To learn more, there are a couple of different websites you can go to. One focuses more on Vanessa and her work, and that's at vanessawoods.net. Vanessa Woods, spelled the usual way, .net. Another is on her book, Bonobo Handshake, and that's at bonobohandshake.com, B-O-N-O-B-O, handshake.com. On both of them, there are lots of photos and videos. And if you'd like to help preserve bonobos, you can go to Lola Ya Bonobo.
LOLAYABonobo.org.
Okay. So we do have to leave it there. Vanessa, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.